Audio on demand from Vision Christian Media.
It was a dream of supreme significance, laying out the sequence of events that will occur until Christ returns. Why did God give this dream to such a wicked king? Today on Turning Point, Dr. David Jeremiah considers this question and examines the meaning behind what he calls the most important dream in all of Scripture. From the handwriting on the wall, here's David to introduce Nebuchadnezzar's nightmare.
Thank you for joining us. Today we open our Bibles to Daniel chapter 2, and the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar is going to have a nightmare. He's going to have a dream that will just terrorize him. He has no idea what it means. He can't find anybody to tell him what it means. And then he meets Daniel. And that's where we're going to be for the rest of this week as we talk about Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Well, let's find out what the king of Babylon was all about. Why was he dreaming? What is his dream all about? And why was it so frightening to him? Next here on Turning Point.
King Nebuchadnezzar is by far the most important pagan king in all of the Bible. More press is given to him than to any other Gentile ruler. He is, in fact, the first Gentile ruler to interrupt the nation of Israel and its leadership. Yet according to chapter 4 of this book and the 17th verse, this man was the basest of all men. We've already learned that he's a wicked, despotic king. He stands in many respects as a type of the Antichrist because of his cruel and Satan-inspired devices. The Bible teaches us in the book of Daniel that all men trembled before this king. You'll read that in chapter 1, verse 10, and again in chapter 5 and verse 19. All of the world trembled before King Nebuchadnezzar, but he trembled before no man. He trembled before nothing. Nothing, that is, except his dreams. And here in our chapter, in the first verse of chapter 2, we read that Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams, and his spirit was troubled, and his sleep went from him. And over in the fourth chapter, in the fifth verse, we read that he saw a dream which made him afraid, and a vision which troubled him. It's hard for us to understand it, and it's hard for us to get a hold of it, but here is a man who is the ruler of the world. He is secure upon his throne. All of his enemies have been subdued, and yet he is still unable to sleep. According to the 29th verse of chapter 2, the problem with Nebuchadnezzar sleeping is that he is filled with anxiety over the future. He is worried about what should come to pass hereafter. He is suffering in some respects from royal insomnia. Perhaps he is an illustration of Shakespeare's famous line, "Thus conscience doth make cowards of us all." Or perhaps even better, he personifies the phrase, "Uneasy lies the head that wears the crown." For whatever reason, Nebuchadnezzar sounds like pious Job in the Old Testament, who on one occasion in the 7th chapter in verse 14 said to God, "Thou scarest me with dreams and terrifieth me with visions." A prophetic writer by the name of John Urquhart has written about this king's dream, and I think he has put his finger on what's keeping Nebuchadnezzar awake at night. He writes these words. He said, "The warrior's spirit cannot rest. The power he holds is not something to be enjoyed. It is something to be used. It is a means, not an end. He has retired to rest, but the busy brain pursues its all-absorbing fancy. Whither will he turn his arms? In what way may he most effectually break the power he means to attack? When he and his stand alone in the earth, what then? The dominion has returned again to Babylon, the ancient mistress of the kingdoms, but will it remain there? In dreams, he still pursues ambition's paths. The ever-changing fancies sweep through the soul in their swift, unending fight. But at last their aimless career is checked and built out of the dreamer's thoughts upon his bed. A vision rises, clear, consistent, and terrible. As far as the king is concerned, this is a sleepless night punctuated by a terrifying dream. As far as God is concerned, this is a vehicle through which he will reveal the commencement, the character, the course, and the consummation of the times of the Gentiles. Harry Ironside has written of this chapter that it contains the most complete and yet the most simple prophetic picture that we have in all of the Word of God. Without question, what we are studying is the most amazing dream in all of the Bible. It begins in its coverage with the time of Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar, and it extends throughout history all the way to the reign of Christ, the King of the heavens, who sets up his reign upon the earth, the thousand-year reign and millennium of our Lord. Now, chapter 2 is a very long chapter. It has 49 verses. The chapter really divides itself into two major units. Verses 1 through 30 give us the history of Nebuchadnezzar's dream and how Daniel interpreted it. And then beginning at verse 31 and going through verse 49, we have the actual dream itself and what it meant. Now, verses 1 through 30 record the story of the king's dream, and it seems to me that it most naturally unfolds itself in the following way. It is like a three-act play. Act 1, verses 1 to 13, Nebuchadnezzar is on the stage all by himself. A few supporting cast, but he's the center of attraction. Daniel's not in the picture. Act 2, verses 14 to 23, the scene is now Daniel's little cottage in he's the central figure on the stage. And then Act 3 begins at verse 24 and goes through 30, and that's Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar both on the stage together. So a three-act play, and that's how we'll study the passage, just as quickly as we can move through the narrative, but getting all that we can get along the way. So notice, first of all, Act 1, Nebuchadnezzar on stage, verses 1 to 13. Now, it is obvious that chapter 2 begins chronologically right after the events of chapter 1. Verse 18 of chapter 1 lets us know that the end of their days of examination has come. Speaking of the Hebrew children, you remember if you've been studying with us that they've been in school for 3 years. And now they have come and have graduated at the end of the first chapter. And you remember that Daniel graduated magna cum laude. He was the head of the class. Their graduation is over. And now chapter 2 begins. And the events of chapter 2 follow the graduation of the Hebrew children from their schooling. But that poses a most interesting problem with us, because chapter 2 begins in a very confusing way. For it says in chapter 2, "Now in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar." And we ask ourselves this question, now wait a minute. How long were they in school? 3 years. And who enrolled them in school? Nebuchadnezzar. And so he was there at the beginning of their schooling, and now we begin chapter 2, and it says it's only the second year of his reign. How do we explain that? Well, it's a very interesting explanation, and it's a very logical one. For according to Babylonian reckoning, and Daniel was writing from the court of Babylon as a Babylonian, according to Babylonian reckoning, a king did not count in Babylon his first year as a part of his reign. It was called his year of accession. And as he acceded the throne, that was a year set apart as a parenthesis, and he began to reckon time at the beginning of the second year. So as we go back to the first chapter, we know that the first year when Daniel and his friends were brought to Israel was the king's year of accession. And then we have the second and the third year, or the first and the second year, according to Babylonian time. Now, at the end of the second year, we are in chapter 2. You see where I'm coming from? So this is the end of the second year of the reign of King Nebuchadnezzar. But remember, his father died, and he ascended the throne just as Daniel and his friends were coming into Babylon. So we are now locked into the right time sequence, and we're ready to understand what's going on in the life of King Nebuchadnezzar. We begin under Act 1 with Roman numeral 1 or number 1 or point A or however you keep notes, with the king's dream. Chapter 2, verse 1. And it says that Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams, and his spirit was troubled, and his sleep went from him. Now, the story is this. The king has recently come into power, and he has great perplexity about the future. He is at the top, but now he has so much to lose that he is so worried about what might happen to him. The problems of the day become the problems of the night, and he takes them to bed with him. And he could conquer dynasties, but he couldn't conquer his own dreams. May I just stop for a moment and say that in some respects, Nebuchadnezzar is a contemporary of ours, for you and I both know many who have risen to the top, but have discovered that it provides them many sleepless nights because of the responsibility that they have received. Now, according to the Bible, there are two ways that God spoke in the visionary way. He spoke in dreams, which was something he did when a person was asleep, and he spoke in visions, which was like a dream, only they were awake when they received the vision. Way back in the Old Testament book of Numbers, chapter 12 and verse 6, we are told that if there be a prophet among you, I, the Lord, will make myself known in a vision, and I will speak in a dream. In the Old Testament days and in the Old Testament times, God often spoke to his own through the dreams. Solomon had a dream. And you know about the dreams of Joseph and the very special dream that Jacob had recorded in the book of Genesis. All of these are God's people. But the amazing thing as you study the Old Testament, and it's focused in this chapter, is that God not only spoke to his own people through dreams, but quite often he spoke to pagans through dreams. For instance, do you remember when Abraham was involved with Abimelech, the king of Gerar, and he gave Sarah, who was his wife, unto the king because he was afraid of him? And the Bible records in the book of Genesis that it was through a dream that God warned Abimelech that Sarah was the wife of Abraham. And he was not a godly man. The Bible teaches us that on an occasion when Gideon was fighting against the Midianites, that God spoke to one of the Midianites through a dream and gave him a vision of the fact that they were going to be conquered in battle. And here in this chapter, we have the story of God speaking to wicked King Nebuchadnezzar by means of a dream. Now, I've got to stop just a moment and ask a couple of questions. First question is this. Since when has God revealed his prophetic plan to an ungodly, despotic king? That's a good question. We've already said this is the most important dream in the Bible, and God allowed it to be given to a wicked king. How do you explain that? Well, the answer is an indication of the times. May I say to you that at this particular moment in the history of Israel, there was very little difference between the Jews and the Babylonians. If I could put it this way, God didn't have much to choose from. The Jewish people were as wicked as the Babylonians. And it's almost as if God is addressing them in some sort of a sarcastic way by saying, I'll show you what kind of shape you're in. I'll reveal my great prophetic plan to the most wicked king in the land. But I'd like to also point out that Nebuchadnezzar stands in a unique place because he is the first Gentile king to be the ruler of the land. And what is the nature of this dream that we're studying? It is God's plan for the times of the Gentiles. And wouldn't it be natural that God would reveal his plan for the times of the Gentiles to a Gentile king? And that's what he's doing. Well, that's the king's dream. Now, we move on to the second verse, and we notice the king's determination. And the king commanded the magicians and the astrologers and the sorcerers and the Chaldeans to show the king his dream. So they came and stood before the king. And the king said unto them, I have dreamed a dream, and my spirit was troubled to know the dream. Then spoke the Chaldeans to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell thy servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation. Now, the king had this terrible dream, and he called in his brain trust the next day. It was his cabinet. And the cabinet was made up of four different groups. The magicians, who according to the text were more scholars than magicians. The word there is the word that is tied into the word stylos or pen. It means those who write. The magicians were scholars. And then he called in the astrologers, the stargazers, if you will. And along with that, the sorcerers. Now, the sorcerers were men who were involved in incantations and had contact with the dead. They were the mediums of their day. And along with that, the Chaldeans. May I point out that the word Chaldean here is not a geographical reference, but it is a term which has to do with the wise men of Babylon. When we see that in a context like this, it is a reference to the wisest of the wise men. So now the king has his brain trust in front of him, and he wants them to tell him the meaning of this terrible dream that he had the night before. It's interesting to note that beginning at the fourth verse of the second chapter and concluding at the end of the seventh chapter in the book of Daniel, in the original language of the Old Testament, you're going through the Bible, you're reading Hebrew, 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 until you get to chapter 2 and verse 4, and then the language switches and you've got Aramaic from chapter 4 all the way to the end of chapter 7. And one of the reasons for that is that that's the prophecy that deals with the Gentiles, and that's the language of the Babylonian court. That's the language Daniel's been studying for 3 years, and so it is no problem for him to write that message in Aramaic or in the Chaldean language. And that message then is communicated in this prophetic book. That's the king's determination. He calls the men in and he says, "You're my hope to understand my dream, and I want you to tell me what it means." Now we come to the king's dilemma in verse 4. The Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, and this is what you always say to a king: "O king, live forever. Tell thy servants the dream, and we will show thee the interpretation." In other words, they're saying, "You just tell us what your dream is, king, and we'll tell you what it means." But in verse 5, we get to a dilemma. The problem is this: the king answered and said to the Chaldeans, "The thing is gone from me." In other words, I forgot my dream. I mean, that's the problem. He hasn't forgotten how terrible it was. He hasn't forgotten the terror of the dream and how he felt when he was dreaming it, but he cannot remember the details of the dream. Some of you have had that experience, haven't you? Wake up in the morning in a cold sweat, you're not sure why, but you know something bad happened the night before while you were dreaming. And that's what was going on with King Nebuchadnezzar. And he remembered that the dream was terrible. The problem was he just didn't know what the dream was. And of course, in an Oriental culture, a forgotten dream was a bad omen. And Nebuchadnezzar was very much concerned. And that brings us to the king's demand in verse 5. And the king answered and said to the Chaldeans, "The thing is gone from me. If you will not make known unto me the dream with the interpretation of it, you will be cut in pieces and your houses shall be made a dunghill." Now, the king wants to know his dream, and he wants to know the meaning of it, and he's saying to his brain trust, his cabinet, the wisest people in Babylon, and he's given them a valid test. If these men are failures, they're also frauds. If they are able to tell him the meaning of the dream, surely they can tell him also what the dream was. This thing that's going on here in this verse has much far deeper meaning than you see at the surface. It furnishes a demonstration of the incompetence of mere human resources and learning and power to ascertain the mind and the will of God apart from his own revelation. These are pagan men. This is God's revelation. And they come in and they don't know what to do. One can't help but notice as he studies this passage that King Nebuchadnezzar really didn't even believe in his own system, did he? I mean, these are his men. And he's supposed to believe in them. These are the religious leaders of his day. But he doesn't believe in them. He knows they're phonies, and he wants to put them on the spot. So that's what he says. He says, "Look, I'll listen to your interpretation, but first of all, you got to tell me what my dream was." Well, verses 7 through 11 is a very fast-moving interchange between the king and the wise men. You follow in your Bibles, and let me just tell you the story very quickly. In verse 7, the wise men come back again, and they say, "Oh, king, you tell us the dream, and we'll tell you what it means." And the king says, "You're just trying to buy time. That's all you're trying to do. You're stalling for time." Verse 8. And verse 9, the king goes on to say, "You've prepared lying and corrupt words to speak before me till the time is changed. Tell me the dream and I will know you're for real." Now you see, how would you like to be involved with that kind of a trust relationship between you and your religious leader? I mean, here this guy is. He's really dependent upon these men to give him guidance, but he doesn't believe in them. He calls them a bunch of liars. He says, "If I give you a shot at this dream, all you're going to do is tell me the wrong dream. You're just buying time. I don't believe in you." Well, I love what comes next. Verse 10, the wise men say, "There's not a man on earth that can reveal the king's matter. And furthermore, there's not a king on earth who would ever ask him to do such a thing." verse 11 is just beautiful. It's a rare thing that the king requireth. And the king could answer, that's what I pay you guys for, to do rare things. Now, I want you to notice what these men are admitting. Just notice this in passing. Number one, they are admitting that there is not any man on earth who of himself can understand the revelation of God. Mark that down. Isn't that interesting? It's very much like 1 Corinthians 2:14. But the natural man receiveth not the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness unto him, neither can he know them because they are spiritually discerned. These are the natural men, the religious leaders of the day. This is a revelation from God, and they are incapable of locking into its meaning or its understanding. Now, this remark of theirs is at the very core of the real meaning of being a Christian. There is not a man on earth that can show the king's matter. Write that down in your book. There is not a man on earth that can understand the king's matter. That Daniel, who was on the earth, had connections in heaven, and a Christian, therefore, is a man on earth in touch with heaven who is able to bring heaven to bear on the things of earth. That's what a Christian is. That's why these guys couldn't do it.
Well, Daniel sticks out in the pack because he knows God. I was having lunch today with someone. We were talking about what a difference it makes when you know God, how it changes everything in your life. What used to be just the routine of life or the drudgery of life becomes a divine adventure. And Daniel's living out this divine adventure, and he's about to enter the scene. And Nebuchadnezzar will never be the same. Daniel will never be the same. And in reality, the world will never be the same. And that's a part of our lesson for today. And tomorrow we'll finish up Nebuchadnezzar's nightmare. Then we'll learn what it all means going forward on Thursday and Friday. And oh, by the way, if you'd like to have the devotionals downloaded into your email file, hundreds of thousands of people do that. They get the devotionals through their email. And we'll help you do that if you ask about it when you call or write today. See you tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
For more information on Dr. Jeremiah's series, The Handwriting on the Wall, please visit our website, davidjeremiah.org/radio, where we offer two free ways to help you stay connected, our monthly magazine, Turning Points, and our daily email devotional. Sign up today at davidjeremiah.org/radio. That's davidjeremiah.org/radio. Ask for a copy of David's companion book for this series on the secrets of the prophecies of Daniel, The Handwriting on the Wall. It's yours for a gift of any amount. You can also purchase the Jeremiah Study Bible in the English Standard Version and New International Version, as well as in standard or large print in the New King James, all available in your choice of handsome cover options. Go to davidjeremiah.org/radio for all the details. Join us tomorrow as we continue the series, The Handwriting on the Wall, here on Turning Point with Dr. David Jeremiah.
Thanks for taking time to listen to this audio on demand from Vision Christian Media. To find out more about us, go to vision.org.au.